No one's quick as Gaston. No one's quick as Gaston. No one's next as incredibly fast as Gaston. There's no man in town if it's manly. Perfect, a pure paragon.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That's a song from the new live-action Disney version of Beauty and the Beast, which opens in theaters tomorrow, March 17th. The song is sung by the character of Le Fou, who the film's director has revealed would have a nice, exclusively gay moment in the film. This revelation has been met with mixed response. Banned altogether in Malaysia, the film also will not be shown at a drive-in in Alabama. There may be more such fallout to come. And even LGBTQ supporters have mixed emotions about director Bill Condon's revelation that Le Fou is gay. We decided to consider the history of LGBTQ image in film. And joining us by phone is New York Times reporter who covers Hollywood, Brooks Barnes. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you? Thanks.
I'm fine, thank you. This is the first time a character has been explicitly identified as gay in a Disney movie. Why is this significant?
Significant because of the word Disney. That carries such power in the marketplace, and it's kind of charged in a way. I mean, the actual character, without giving, going into spoiler territory too much, I guess. It's really the most basic flicker and the moment, the exclusively gay moment that he mentioned is maybe 3 seconds. So it's kind of taken on a life of its own.
It's sort of more about the fact that they announced it openly.
Right. I mean, it's interesting in all sorts of ways in terms of how the media has responded, but also the director saying that, and I sort of know from covering Disney that that article was not, they didn't love that happened, and so they've kind of been playing cleanup ever since.
Well, we did invite, of course, Disney to join the conversation today, and they either declined or didn't respond. I don't know what happened with that, because I would be interested in knowing. Because, of course, they let him forge ahead with that. They could have easily, it's a 3-second scene. They could have edited it out if they wanted.
The part, what I've been told, I've covered Disney for, 10 years now here, and they, from people I talked to, they said that they were hoping that it would kind of be just discovered without that spotlight being pointed on it.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, many people may not have even noticed, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But as it is, it's become kind of one of the defining things about this film, which is really expensive. It's really important to Disney from, its empire perspective, and so, yeah, it's made for some tense moments over there in Burbank.
Because, of course, in Malaysia, they've asked them to edit out that 3-second spot, and Disney has openly declined to do that.
Right, and that puts Disney in a tricky position, mm-hmm. because with other filmmakers in the creative community here, once you start openly bending to that sort of censorship, that could create a whole nother controversy. And I think Malaysia is not an important enough marketplace to Disney to do that. The risk of editing versus not showing it is just not a they made that calculation.
I'm interested to see what happens in Russia, where they've limited access to the film, saying if you're under 16, you have to be with someone 16 years and older, and what that will do.
It's kind of been a rolling story, right? Like, it started with the director saying exclusively gay moment, which what does that really mean?
I don't even know what that means exactly.
Right. and then came the Alabama drive-in, and then came the Russian story, and then now Malaysia. And what's interesting to me is one of the things is that a lot of this has happened without the film even being seen.
Right.
The Russian minister was like, "Oh, I haven't seen it," you know. But this is an outrage, and we've got to do something, which speaks so much to sort of the power of the internet and the mentality in the world right now, I think.
You know, I noted it at the top of the hour that it's maybe there's a little irony here, I don't know, but we're examining the history of LGBTQ characters in film, inspired by a story that asks its audience, after all, to look inside a person for their essence. I mean, it was an interesting story to come out, no pun intended, to come out with this in the first place.
There's so many things about this particular material, right? Like the folks in Alabama who are super, you know, upset about a gay character, but the, you know, a person falling in love with an animal is perfectly fine.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You've written that Disney has been a leader in representing diversity on the screen in recent years, but this is the first gay character that's been featured. In what way has Disney been a leader in representing diversity?
Hollywood has a terrible track record.
That's for sure.
That way, Disney has tried more than a lot of the others, both in what's coming and what has been shown already. In terms of race, you know, African American actors, and Disney overall, yes, this is the first openly gay character in a Disney movie. It's certainly not the first gay character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just usually subtext and not open text, whatever the opposite of that is.
Uh-huh.
But if you look across the sort of Disney empire, there's on Disney Channel, for example, Doc McStuffins is a preschool cartoon with a African American girl as the lead character. That is not typical, and that's been there for several years now. And there are sort of examples all around for LGBTQ from Disney in the parks, for example. They've been a leader in sort of saying that this event, Gay Days, can happen, even though a lot of pushback has happened to that. So they actually do get credit for Lion King on Broadway. You know, a lot of African-American performers there. So,
okay. LeFou wasn't originally written as gay, but the film's director, Bill Condon, decided to add that scene that confirms his sexuality or his sexual preference at the end of the movie. It kind of says something about the importance of not just what's in front of the camera, but what's behind the camera, too, in Hollywood, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Bill Condon is openly gay. There are a lot of gay people working on the film. I mean, one of the things that's been interesting to me to watch is that even though, while this controversy is played out, people who don't know the story, LeFou is the sort of bumbling manservant to Gaston, who is the sort of epitome of masculinity, the strapping guy who is out for Belle come hell or high water. And that cast in that role is an openly gay actor, Luke Evans. And
The Gaston role.
In the Gaston role,
right.
Which has no one has bat an eye about that.
Right.
At the same time, but it speaks to the power of Disney. The people look to that as a family, you know, seal of approval, and for some families, you know, they don't want that.
Is there? Do you sense any kind of that there's also a bottom line for Disney in this, that they're seeing the family changing out there and they're okay with that, and there's a lot more people who know gay people and support gay people than that?
Yes. I think just last week, Disney had its annual shareholder meeting in Denver, and I thought it was interesting that Bob Iger, who's the chief executive of the company, was asked not about this particular incident or representation, but about, I think it was in a political way, actually, why aren't you speaking out against Trump and other injustices this shareholder representative saw in the world. And Iger's response was kind of general, and he said, we as a company really believe that the best way to impact culture and to, you know, send messages is through our content. And he cited, for example, Zootopia, an animated big hit last year, uh-huh. about diversity and acceptance. And so definitely there's an awareness at Disney that the world is changing, so, you know, not all at once. And there's going to be pushback, but they want to be on. It's kind of like a toe in the water, right? If any other film did this, it kind of wouldn't have, or if the director hadn't come out and said what he said, it kind of wouldn't have been a big deal, I don't think.
You know, I'm trying to think. I'm sure there's an example out there, but I'm trying to think of a Disney movie that hasn't been about diversity and acceptance. Do you know
really
what I mean?
Point.
Right to Fox and the Hound. I mean, you know, and then we've got interspecies issues going on. But I, you know, really, it's been the underlying theme of pretty much every Disney movie I've ever seen.
Finding yourself, you know, believing in yourself. Right. It's kind of the formula.
Do you, some are worried, you know, going back to the whole LeFou depiction itself, that it's kind of stereotyped. It could also be in reinforcing, not negative stereotypes, but just stereotypes in general about gay men. What's been the blowback on that score?
There definitely has been a blowback. It's been quieter because the, you know, the ban, the you know, and to put that in perspective, the ban, I mean, it's one drive-in theater in Alabama.
Yeah,
okay,
right. Maybe 1,000 people will see. Yeah, absolutely. I've kind of tried to be ironic about that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and nothing, I mean, some of the comments about, you know, a drive-in perhaps representing how ironic is or perfect is that of another time. But yes, the characterization of LeFou is, you know, he's kind of his feminine mannerisms, and he's played by a character, an actor, Josh Gad, who is not gay,
right.
And that can also be controversial or can arch eyebrows and among gay people, right? You know, why are you representing us this way in the shorthand being sort of a limp wrist and a frolicsome behavior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Except that the Gaston, who's not gay in the movie, is gay.
Right.
The actor is. So, you know, it's a crazy world. Do you think other major movie studios that haven't yet released films featuring characters like this or, you know, that are in the genre of Disney will be encouraged, emboldened by this? Or do you think there's going to be a wait and see attitude to see what the bottom line looks like?
I think two things. The bottom line is not going to be impacted. The film is kind of shaping up to be a juggernaut. It'll probably open to $130 million or more.
Have you seen it?
I have. Mm-hmm.
Do you like it?
As a reporter, I try not to.
Oh, you're not a reviewer. That's right.
I'm not
that's
a
right.
critic.
God,
yeah,
sorry about
so
that.
I try to keep
of
that
course.
Myself. But it's, you know, an extravaganza. It's a big, huge, expensive movie. Early reviews have been good, and if you look at the sort of the tea leaves, how many views trailers have gotten like on par with Star Wars, which is kind of, you know, it shocked me.
Yeah.
And the ticket sellers like Fandango have said it's their number one family selling movie of all time. So
wow. Okay.
You know, it's going to be big. But in terms of other studios, Hollywood does not like this kind of attention, you know, and especially the rolling controversy. You know, if it's just a pop, it's one thing. If it's a series of stories over a couple weeks, that's another. And I think it probably would make them not reconsider, but consider more carefully.
Well, Brooks Barnes, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your insights.
Sure. Anytime.
Brooks Barnes is a New York Times reporter who covers Hollywood. More on LGBTQ in film and on television. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This hour, we're talking about the representation of gay and lesbian characters in film, both theatrical and on television. The director of the new Disney live-action version of Beauty and the Beast has announced that a character in the film is gay, and there's a three-second scene to prove it. But gay stereotypes aren't as rare in film, and Disney films have been criticized for using those stereotypes to depict villains. The tiger Shere Khan in the animated film version of The Jungle Book is considered a classic example.
Bravo, bravo. An extraordinary performance. And thank you for detaining my victim.
Don't mention it, Your Highness.
Boo.
Joining us now is the director of film and video at the Wexner Center for the Arts, David Filippi. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And by phone, Los Angeles Times film reporter who covers diversity in Hollywood, Trayvell Anderson. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also by phone, the director of film studies at Lawrence University, Amy Ongiri. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Thank you.
Amy, for much of film history, LGBT characters either were not portrayed at all or in a negative light. Where did that come from?
It's true that if we look at movies through the 50s and 60s, we get gay characters mostly wrapped in tragedy, committing suicide, or having unrequited love. And if we think more recently, we see gay characters as villains in things like Silence of the Lambs or even Brokeback Mountain, which is in a lot of ways a positive portrayal. The love is tragic. So it's really important that this character is doing something differently because Disney is really an important barometer for cultural change in U.S. culture.
Why? What is your understanding of why depict at all anyway if it wasn't, even particularly back in the 30s and 40s and whatnot, if it wasn't accepted anyway?
It's really important to know that LGBTQ people have always been present in society, and they've been present in the entertainment industry. So even when it wasn't socially acceptable, people wanted to script themselves into film and television. So the original animated Beauty and the Beast, John Ashman was openly gay, and a lot of people think that he was encoding his struggle with HIV/AIDS towards the end of his life into the character of the Beast as a kind of metaphor for social exclusion and disease. So it's at least partially because LGBTQ people have always been present in society and also in the entertainment industry.
Right, in front of and behind the camera.
Yes.
Yeah. Trayvell Anderson, I wanted to hear what you had to say about this you know, this, well, I mean, who knows how big of a deal it's going to be with Beauty and the Beast, but what's happened here, we just heard from, you know, the New York Times reporter, Brooks Barnes, who says that Hollywood doesn't like this kind of conflict, this kind of publicity.
I don't know if I would agree with that. I mean, I think that, sure, with a soon-to-be blockbuster hit such as Beauty and the Beast, they would love every single country around the world to embrace it. But we do know that Disney, as you all have mentioned, is known for this theme and this storyline about self-acceptance and diversity. Now, it may not have shown up in as explicit ways before, particularly around the LGBT theme. But I think Disney, and as we've seen, they're not interested in cutting the scene to show up in some of these countries that are trying to restrict it. So I think this is kind of that positive publicity that they're interested in.
It's a turning point, a very small turning point, Dave Filippi. But when did the characters, LGBT characters, whether they were, you know, obviously they weren't explicit at the time, but when did they even start to emerge? You know, Amy was saying from the very beginning.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at all of film history, you know, different scholars and historians point to, I mean, as far back as, you know, kind of almost the dawn of cinema.
Silent film.
Oh, certainly silent film.
Yeah.
I mean, even, but, you know, like the aughts and the teens even. And, you know, sometimes it might be someone kind of reading that into the character. But, you know, by the 20s, there were characters that were certainly identified as gay or easily read as gay or lesbian in movies. And, in the early 1930s, kind of the era that we talk about, the first sound era that we look at, or that we call the pre-code era, there were all kinds of instances of gay and lesbian characters, and often they were caricatures and for, you know, kind of for quick comic effect. But when the Hollywood production code was written and then put into practice in 1934, there was a line that specifically forbade sexual perversion. That's how it was worded. It wasn't worded as homosexuality, and that for the most part put the end to any kind of explicit representation of gay and lesbian characters for a couple of decades. And of course, there would be moments where, you know, for something like campy might happen or something where a person might read that into a character. But for the most part, specifically, it wasn't really possible until, you know, there are certainly characters in certain movies in the 50s and 60s and 70s. But as far as kind of like a complete flowering of the representation of gay and lesbian people in movies really started in, I would say, the late 80s and early 90s, both in more commercial films, but especially in what the critic Ruby Rich identified as the new queer cinema, which was for the most part independent films. But people like Christine Vachon and Todd Haynes and Rose Troche and Greg Araki and people making, you know, very explicitly, and I don't mean necessarily sexually explicitly, mm-hmm. but that too. But, you know, these were films, you know, incredibly artistic, well-made films that depicted gay and lesbian people in a whole variety, in a whole wide spectrum.
Not just about being gay, but just that.
But I mean, it could be a sexually explicit film. It could just be, you know, people like Rose Troche's Go Fish, which, I mean, there are some sex scenes in it, but it's also just about, you know, people living their life. Mm-hmm. And that's what was never represented, really. And it was a great moment because it was also this great moment in American independent film in general. Mm-hmm. People like Spike Lee and Jim Jarmusch and Gus Van Sant, where these films were not quite mainstream, but there was a big audience for those films because art house culture was still thriving back then. And I'd say that's the moment where you started to have real, kind of meaningful, well-rounded characters in films that we had never really seen before.
Mm. You know, Amy, I was kind of thinking about when I was listening to Dave talk just a second ago, when he's talking about the dates, the 80s and 90s, that also coincides or correlates with the onset of AIDS. And I'm wondering, and the activism and the turning point in the LGBTQ community because of that.
Yeah, it's not an accident that activism is calling for visibility with groups like Queer Nation and ACT UP at the same moment that visibility is beginning to happen on the screen. Hollywood responds to cultural changes, and activism was forcing a really important cultural change.
And it was also sending signals, right, Treval Anderson, that there was an interest in this and that people would pay for it.
Definitely, very much so. I think we see that even today when we hear, you know, with Black Lives Matter and all these calls for diversity and inclusion, we see kind of that response in the types of films, types of television shows that we're seeing.
Because Hollywood needs a bottom line, as opposed to the, everybody wants a good bottom line, but Hollywood needs one.
Yeah, well, you know, we know that diversity sells. It always has. And when people are able to see themselves reflected on the screen, they show up.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are looking at the depiction of LGBTQ characters in film and on television today. It was spurred by the issue surrounding the live action film of Beauty and the Beast. It's set to hit the theaters March 17th. That's tomorrow. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Amy Ongiri, what are some of the landmark films that have brought realistic LGBTQ characters to the scene, to the screen, I should say?
There's a kind of long history dating back to the 20s, as has already been said.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the important movies, I think even just bringing a kind of visibility, even if negatively, would be things like The Children's Hour, Tea and Sympathy, 56 for Tea and Sympathy, 61 for The Children's Hour. And then, as has already been said, in the 80s, there's this whole birth of independent films. Filmmakers like Marlon Riggs bring things like Tongues Untied that really get to a kind of authentic experience of LGBTQ life that's not just about representing homosexuality as a problem, but representing the fullness of life for LGBT people. But because LGBTQ people are so present in the entertainment industry, they've always been kind of shadow characters, especially in Disney, that are coded as queer, but are not necessarily explicitly written as queer. So a film like The Wizard of Oz is an important queer film, I would argue, because it's so much based around articulating a kind of campy queer identity.
What? Tell me about that. Wizard of Oz, in what way?
We could look at a character like the Cowardly Lion,
yeah,
as kind of representing that search for identity and that desire to articulate yourself even in the face of everyone telling you that you shouldn't. And even with the kind of campy set and the kind of extravagance of the set reflects a certain kind of queer culture of the moment.
You know, David, The Children's Hour, you know, obviously it was written by Lillian Hellman first, and then shown, you know, the movie came out later. So there is also a correlate, or there's a relationship there, not just in film, but also with literature, mm-hmm, and what's being, mm-hmm, written about at the time.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of going back in the memory banks. If I remember correctly, I mean, it was a play, certainly,
right,
first. And I think it even had some censorship problems when it first appeared as a play, but it was so critically acclaimed that they made an exception for the play. And then it was the director, William Wyler, actually made a version of it, I think in the 30s. But it wasn't called The Children's Hour because of censorship issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then
it was based on, right?
Yeah. And then, of course, William Wyler made the version that most people are familiar with from 1961. And there were, you know, part of the reason we were starting to see more gay and lesbian characters in, say, the late 50s and then throughout the 60s was the production code was weakening. I mean, studios were starting to ignore it, and then eventually it just kind of you know, crumbled away, and people were starting to make films with all kinds of content that was just not possible 10 years earlier.
And also going back to the production code, Amy Angiri, I read that before that went into effect in the 30s, that the depiction, you know, the implicit depiction of lesbians and gays in movies, particularly gay men, was kind of that gay for free, you know, the limp wrist stereotypes. And then after it was because of that, or after that production code, that that's when it turned to a darker depiction that, yeah, we're here, but it's darker now. It's the, you know, the Shere Khans of the world, you know, the evil people.
Yes, definitely. But even pre-code, there's a lesbian comedy. I'm blanking on the title. David, maybe you can help me.
The one with Clara Bow in it. I'm blanking on it.
Yeah.
Too. I think I know the film you're talking about.
But, yeah, it's set in Florida. There's a kind of diversity of representation pre-code
That
really just hasn't exactly been fully explored and needs to be thought about. That, as David said, the code really shuts down. And there's also a kind of anxiety around changes in sexual expression in general in the 50s and 60s and gender, obviously, with the beginning of the women's movement, mm-hmm. that the kind of the turn to the dark, I think, is expressing a kind of cultural anxiety of the moment around those issues.
We're going to continue our conversation. We're talking about depiction of lesbians, gays, and more in the movies these days, triggered by the recent controversy surrounding Beauty and the Beast. It opens March 17th. That's tomorrow. All over the place. It's supposed to be a blockbuster. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The media monitoring group GLAAD, that's GLAAD, reported that in 2015, nearly one out of every five major studio films featured an LGBTQ character. GLAAD also looked at television. Of the 895 series regular characters expected to appear on broadcast scripted primetime programming this year, 43 were identified as gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or queer. That might not sound like a lot, but it's the most ever, according to GLAAD. Still with us is the director of film and video at the Wexner Center for the Arts, Dave Philippi, and by phone, film reporter with the Los Angeles Times, who covers diversity in Hollywood, Trayvell Anderson, and the director of film studies at Lawrence University, Amy Angiri. And welcome to all of you again. You know, Trayvell Anderson, when we look at those numbers, my first thing is like, well, big deal. And then I continued reading the report and saw that it's the most ever. And it shows you when we were during the break, David Philippi and I were talking about how when there isn't a lot out there, what is out there is judged sometimes more harshly or not more unfairly or maybe not at all as much as it should be. But I don't exactly see it as a barrage. There's not that much to talk about, is there?
There definitely is not. But I think in most recent years, we've seen, you know, Transparent and Glee and Orange is the New Black, and everyone just thinks there is a barrage of LGBT representation. But it's really not that much. And so when it comes to criticisms of these particular cultural productions, they end up taking on a weight of representation that some might say they shouldn't have to deal with. But when there's only, say, a few representations out there, you know, people would love for them to be fully realized in nuanced depiction.
Yeah, according to GLAAD, LGBT representation in Hollywood is improving, but many of those characters remain in supporting roles. What's keeping the entertainment industry from featuring those narratives more prominently?
Well, I think it's the idea that they just don't know if a movie can have a queer lead and sell. You know, we've been talking about the bottom line and how that's very important for studios. what we've seen is that gay characters do well in the supporting roles. They do well in the stereotypes of, you know, the gay best friend, the hairdresser, the drag queen, you know, needed for comedic relief.
Mm-hmm.
Can they lead a story that's all about them that may not even necessarily be about the fact that they're gay? They just
right.
happen to be gay. We don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Amy Aguirre, I mean, Brokeback Mountain. Well, let's listen to a cut from it first before I ask you. LGBT characters are often portrayed by straight actors, such as in the Academy Award winning film Brokeback Mountain. In the scene, this scene, characters played by Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger talk about their first romantic encounter.
This is a one shot thing we got going on here.
It's nobody's business but ours.
You know I ain't queer.
Me neither.
Okay, that's like one of the saddest movies I've ever seen in my life. but it was about being gay in a time. It wasn't just gay as a, you know, a matter of course, and it was part of the, not part of the story. It was all about it. Amy Aguirre?
And it's interesting when we talk about the bottom line that a movie like Moonlight has managed to do so well.
Of course.
And it's developed out of this independent impulse that David was talking about earlier. It's developed independently, but then its release is, you know, done differently. But it really kind of scripts a more complex representation of gay identity and gay love than was available even in a such an important film like Brokeback Mountain. And the character in Beauty of the Beast, Beauty and the Beast is still a sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
It's a subplot to the quote-unquote real story. But I think it's really significant, something that we haven't said so far, is that it's a children's movie.
Yeah.
Because we learn to be who we are primarily through Disney. I mean, we learn how to do love and romance through Disney since it's so prevalent in our culture. So I think it's really important that even though it's a sidekick, that it's in a children's movie.
Well, and I mentioned before in the first segment of the program today that I can't think of, now I could be corrected, but I cannot think of a Disney movie that didn't have to do with diversity and acceptance and accepting yourself for who you are ever. Amy?
Yeah, that's very true. But it's important that it's not coded queer, but is explicitly, the character is explicitly struggling with same-sex feelings, same-gender love. And so the explicitness, I think, is the important part of this film, even though that's always been a theme in Disney, outsiderness, exclusion, coming to love yourself, but that it's explicitly gay is important.
This year's Oscar, as Amy mentioned, David Filippi went to Moonlight. Oscar for Best Picture went to Moonlight. Coming-of-age story about an African-American gay man. Also implications that it's, you know, there's the actor, I think, that portrayed them. One of the ages of that child, of that man, is Somali, of Somali descent. Does this signify real change, particularly given the impact the movie's had at the box office?
You know, I think it's a complicated answer. I don't think you can ever look at, especially when you're talking about Hollywood, you can never look at one film and say it represents a change. I think it's, you know, it's accumulation of things. And, you know, just going back to Beauty and the Beast for a moment, I mean, I anticipate the film's going to come out. It's going to be a huge blockbuster. No one's going to care about the gay character. And everyone will move on, and that hurdle, that very small hurdle, will be crossed, and it won't be a big deal. And I fully anticipate, maybe it's 5 years, maybe it's 10 years, but there are going to be Pixar films where, you know, maybe there's the main character is not necessarily queer, but maybe there'll be a kid in one of the movies where the parents are same sex or whatever. Mm-hmm. I really think that that's around the corner. And you know, if you in my one person example, but, you know, kids don't really care about that kind of stuff, you know. And if you look at comic books and other movies and other forms of media that they're exposed to, you know, they're learning. This is an overgeneralization, but they're learning to be, you know, accepting and celebrating difference. And I really you know, I think as our population ages and, you know, with the kids coming up, I think we're going to see this just – Moonlight's just the tip of the iceberg is what I'm thinking.
And, you know, Amy, you mentioned that Disney's for kids, but if Disney and Pixar and all the rest of them hadn't done a better job of attracting me as an adult, I think I would have run off into the sunset screaming bloody murder. I mean, they also appeal to parents and Treville Anderson, I mean, you know, they want people to want to bring their kids to these movies. And a lot of people have been critical of Disney for being too stereotypical when it came to gender roles and that kind of a thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that when you look at Disney movies, Pixar movies, the animated genre in general, that is supposed to bring families into the cineplexes, they do helm a little close to some of these stereotypical images when we think of LGBTQ people. That said, it seems like that's kind of their way to get into and get at diversity. So I think ultimately we want those fully realized, nuanced characters that don't rest on stereotype, that don't rest on, you know, effeminate ways of being to clue in and code to us that they're gay or queer, but we want them to be able to be fully queer and still be, you know, integral parts of the storyline.
Have film and television moved at different rates in terms of representation, Treville Anderson?
Oh, definitely. Television has always been kind of the leading, if you will, when it comes to a diversity of all sorts. Even right now, we see, you know, black representation, Latino representation, Asian representation doing a whole lot better on television than we see in film. This last year kind of particularly being historic in terms of those types of representations. On the LGBT front, as I said earlier, Transparent, Netflix's Orange is the New Black, Glee, Will and Grace, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. You can go back a little bit further in terms of some of these representations that truly seem to be historic in terms of pushing the envelope forward for representation. The film, on the other hand, it's a little slower, in part because, you know, it takes movies a little bit longer than TV shows to get made. But yeah, film appears to at least be catching up, albeit slowly.
I'm remembering, you know, I think as far back as the Archie Bunker, All in the Family, I think I remember an episode where Edith had a friend. I can't remember if the friend was transgender or just...
It was actually Archie, wasn't it?
Well, but the person, the character was killed, if I remember correctly. And Edith just, there was a whole episode about why would someone do this to this, you know, wonderful person just because they were different in this way. And so that's all the way back to All in the Family.
I don't remember that, but I remember that Archie had an old friend or an old teacher or coach or something that was transgender or had transitioned.
Well, it might have been that
same
episode. Yeah,
but I don't remember
then,
them being killed. I guess I blocked that out.
And maybe I'm conflating episodes. But anyway, they were addressing it on All in the Family as far back as that. So,
you know, let's talk about – we haven't talked about the issue of who plays what. Now, obviously, Treville Anderson, when we're talking about racial roles that are racially identified, let's say, you're going to have a black person playing a black person and a Hispanic person playing a Hispanic person or whatever, or sometimes not even still in Hollywood,
right.
Amazingly, right? Isn't it a trip? But there doesn't seem to be as much compunction about whether a straight person plays a gay person or a lesbian.
Well, I actually would push back on that.
I think
the community, I think we're getting to, I am gay myself. I think the community is getting to a point to where we're not just necessarily accepting having the representation of a gay character, but we would love to see gay actors, be able to play these roles. We see straight actors play straight and gay and everything else in between, trans, all the time, but the actors who are actually gay and live their lives LGBTQ people, they often don't get afforded those same opportunities. And so we see it right now, a lot of conversation around the trans characters that we see in a lot of movies being played by cisgender women or cisgender men. And it is a huge controversy. But, you know, I think like I said, the community is interested in seeing those representations go further. And so I think we'll see less and less acceptance of straight characters, straight actors rather, playing LGBTQ people.
Amy Ungiri, why did it come out that way? Why has it been that way historically? Because as you mentioned, as everyone's mentioned, the industry itself has plenty of LGBTQ participation behind the camera. But why did it turn out that in front of the camera, it was straight people?
Well,
so much?
It's very hard to be a trans actor or openly gay or lesbian or queer actor in Hollywood to this moment. But I think Travell is right that not only the community but mainstream audiences are demanding the complexity that communities speaking for themselves can actually bring to the screen. And I think that's something that's part of the success of Moonlight, that there's a complexity there that hasn't been seen in the kind of representation when it's either a straight writer or a straight actor playing those, voicing those characters. The complexity gets lost. But, I mean, there's still a lot of bigotry in every industry, but in the entertainment industry especially. And, I mean, we see these controversies with race. There's a controversy around Ghost in the Shell and the casting of a white actor to play the main role in that. So it hasn't totally gone away along in race either.
And just to clear up some of the confusion regarding All in the Family, they had an episode where Archie finds out his buddy is gay in 1971, and then there's another 1975 episode that featured a transgender person, which may be the Edith episode on that score. So, I'm just kind of curious, is everybody going to see Beauty and the Beast this weekend? Travell Anderson?
I mean, I'm going to see it. It's one of those kind of tentpole blockbuster movies that you kind of have to see. So I'll definitely be checking it out.
Yeah, I'm going to see it, but I mean, 3 seconds isn't a selling point for me personally. What about you, Amy Ungiri? Where do you think this will fall in the the long history?
Well, like a lot of people, I've a bunch of kids, so we're definitely, me and my partner are taking our kids to see it.
Uh-huh.
But I think a few seconds actually does matter
okay. When
it comes to Disney. And I mean, we've even seen this in the evolution of Disney princesses, like the female characters you see now are quite different than the character that my kids see are quite different than I saw in films like Sleeping Beauty. So I think it does matter.
Everything from the voice, the voice intonations. I mean, it's all different, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing. What about you, yeah. Dave Filippi?
Well, our 8-year-old is a huge Harry Potter fan, too, and Hermione
yes.
is playing Beauty. So, yes, there are many reasons to go, and we'll definitely be going.
Well, I want to thank all of you for joining us. David Filippi, Director of Film and Video at Wexner Center for the Arts, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Travell Anderson, film reporter with the Los Angeles Times, who covers diversity in Hollywood. Thanks again for joining us, Travell.
Thank you so much.
And Amy Ungiri, she's Director of Film Studies at Lawrence University. Amy, appreciate your time today.
Thanks for inviting me.
And thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lanat, the All Sides interns are Sarah Stacy, who produced this program, Kyle McKinnon and Emily Sink, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. That's it. For All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.